You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Erica Mactinger about pigeon fever in horses. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Mactinger is an associate professor of entomology and extension vector-borne disease team lead at Pennsylvania State University's College of Agricultural Sciences. Her research focuses on filth fly control in livestock, poultry, and equine facilities, transmission of zoonotic disease via arthropod vectors, and integrated tick management. Her work is an interdisciplinary combination of population and chemical ecology, behavior studies, parasitoid host interactions, biological control, molecular biology, toxicology, and wildlife biology. She believes integrated research is necessary to develop novel control methods for disease-spreading insects and agricultural pests as health risks increase from population growth, climate change, and increased pesticide resistance. Thank you, Dr. Mactinger, for joining us.
I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. To get us started, can you briefly walk us through the pathogenesis of pigeon fever in horses?
Yeah, sure. So pigeon fever is caused by a bacterium. It's called Cornibacterium pseudotuberculosis, and it's something that can persist in the environment. So you find it in soil, you find it in bedding, organic materials. So it's just kind of out there. And infection with horses kind of starts when that bacteria gets into the body of the horse. So that can be through something like a small wound or some sort of compromised skin. And that can happen, you know, of course, rolls in it or you're sharing materials, but it's also something that can be transmitted by flies. So flies are, you know, they fly around, right? They get in the soil, they get on your horses, and they can act as something called the mechanical vector, meaning they can move that bacteria from the contaminated material or something like a draining abscess and then transfer it to other horses. Once that bacteria gets in, it kind of triggers this inflammation response, an abscess formation. And some horses that stays very localized, and some it can spread and lead to more serious forms like internal abscesses or limb infections. So that's kind of how it moves through the animal.
Where is pigeon fever endemic in the U.S. and is that shifting at all?
Yeah, so historically, pigeon fever was mostly associated with dry, kind of arid regions, Western United States. It moved into places like Florida. When I was in graduate school, University of Florida, that's when I first heard of it. And I know my vet down in Florida has had a couple cases here and there, but now it's showing up more frequently in the Midwest and the East Coast. And that's probably being driven by a combination of factors. So like I said, this bacteria is kind of in the environment. Horses are moving a lot more, right? We're moving them across the United States more and into different regions for horse shows or for sales. And we're also getting better at kind of recognizing it and diagnosing it. So there's a lot of those pieces going into it. From an insect perspective, of course, changes to climate and land use can influence fly populations. So how long the flies are active, when they become active. And because flies are so good at moving, not just this bacteria, but a lot of different types of bacteria from contaminated environments to horses, it is an important piece of how the disease kind of shows up in new places.
Interesting. So I imagine since flies play a big role in transmission that we're most commonly seeing this disease in the summer, but is it truly a summer-specific disease, or can we see it at other times of the year?
So if you're in the Northeast like me, you're probably going to see it in the summer because that's when the flies are active. In other areas of the country, so California, for example, where this bacteria is endemic, it's everywhere, you may have that seasonality be year-round or even go into, so it may be, you may see it all the time, or it may be limited to when it is warmer, but that warm season is much longer than our warm season, depending on where you are in that state. So it kind of depends on what's going on in your region. So I would say if you're seeing flies, the flies are active, it's warm enough, you've got activity, there's a potential risk there.
Yeah, are we seeing any shifts at all in the seasonality just as some of the weather patterns change in different parts of the country and we're getting, big rainstorms and flooding and different weather events?
Yeah, so all of that can impact lots of different things, right? Can impact land, can impact waste management and how people are dealing with manure waste and all those pieces. It also obviously impacts arthropods like flies. So I don't we're not tracking pigeon fever. It's not reportable. It's not something that's we have surveillance for. So I think it's really hard to answer that question. But I think if I take off kind of that like only fact use hat and say, what do I think? I think we're going to see those trends going in the way that the environmental conditions go. So we're seeing longer warm seasons. We're seeing fly pressure increase with that, and that could extend that window. So I would kind of frame it as like a trend and not something we've fully quantified across all the regions.
This podcast is brought to you by Equithrive. Breeding places a unique and time-sensitive demand on the mare's body. Following breeding, a healthy uterine immune response and timely return to balance are essential for creating an optimal environment for conception and early pregnancy. University studies show that Equithrive mare pellets support post-breeding uterine immune balance and inflammatory resolution during the most critical stages of the breeding cycle. Do you have a problem mare? Learn more about the science behind Equithrive mare pellets by clicking the link in the description or visiting equithrive.com. What are some clinical signs that would alert veterinarians that a horse potentially has pigeon fever? I know that the disease can have different clinical presentations, so maybe you can walk us through some of those.
Sure. Yeah. So there are three classifications or three main forms of how pigeon fever exhibits. One of them is that external abscess. So this is like the classic form where pigeon fever kind of got its name. It has nothing to do with pigeons, right? So it's how the horse presents with this kind of protruding abscess on its chest. And it's usually there or on the underside of the horse. There's internal abscessation, which is a little bit more serious and obviously more difficult to detect because you're not seeing it. And that can affect different organs like the liver, the lungs. And then the third form is ulcerative lymphangitis, which affects the limbs and can cause pretty significant swelling and lameness. So across all those forms, you see kind of standard fever, lethargy, reduced appetite. But if you're seeing fever, you're seeing weight loss, poor performance, all those signs that your horse isn't doing well, that's when you really need to get a veterinarian involved. Don't wait for something to abscess.
Can horses develop internal abscessation without having the external, more visible abscesses?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're a veterinarian assessing a horse, I guess, how would you maybe start to think about that as a potential diagnosis if the horse doesn't have sort of the more obvious external signs? Would you just be going, based on like fever and general unwellness or?
Yeah, so this is really where the vet needs to take the lead. So external abscesses are often confirmed by testing drainage and kind of eyeballing it, but right, because you're seeing this very characteristic thing happen. Ultrasounds can help for deeper infections. For the internal forms, diagnostics usually expand to blood work, imaging, sometimes serology. From a management perspective, once you confirm that case, you're also looking closely at fly pressure and environment as kind of an added form.
We talked briefly about this already, but how is pigeon fever transmitted and what sort of biosecurity practices are necessary if you have an infected property?
That's a great question. So transmission is tied to the environment and flies. So when those abscesses drain, when you have a horse that's infected, that material can contaminate the bedding, the soil, stalls, tack equipment, all of those things. And that's where the bacteria can persist in high levels. Those flies are attracted to that. They're called filth flies for a reason, and they can move it around to other horses. So for biosecurity, you're really focusing on two things. You want to contain that infectious material, and you want to reduce fly exposure. So that means isolating the horses, carefully managing that drainage, not sharing equipment, maintaining good hygiene, and really focusing on fly control, which we should do anyway, but definitely during these outbreak times. Fly control here is not really optional. A lot of folks will focus on the horse. The horse is sick, right? We focus on the horse and we focus on, maybe fly prevention on the horse, so we're putting on fly sprays, but it's really an environment-wide thing. So that includes manure removal, eliminating breeding sites, using the barriers like fly sheets and masks, even with the horses that aren't infected, and environmental tools like fans and traps.
Do individually affected horses need to be kept away from unaffected horses at the same property, or is it not going to make too much of a difference when flies are just moving around anyway?
Right. So I guess it's a risk. I am not a veterinarian, so I'm going to speak for the vets, and somebody may come in and say something else. But from my experience as a horse person, any infected individual, whether it's, you know, something that's, you know, rhino or flu or something like that, or strangles, or this disease is sometimes called false strangles because it has this kind of similar abscessy presentation, yep, you're keeping those animals away from the healthy animals. That can help in a lot of ways because the flies are all around, but there are specific way or places where flies tend to be. So if you can isolate an animal away and really focus on fly management, it's kind of multi-pronged. You're trying to keep the level down in the environment. You're trying to keep the flies off the individual. You're trying to keep the flies off the other horses. So, you know, it can also be transmitted by a horse laying down in the grass that another horse lays down in, right? So if they have an open wound. So it's not a great idea to have that space shared by infected animals.
Right. And you said that this is not a reportable disease, correct? So we're not going to be having state mandated quarantines, right, on affected properties. So it's really going to be up to the owner and the veterinarian to practice good biosecurity.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. How, I know you're not a vet, but how do vets typically approach treatment for external and internal disease?
Yeah. So, you know, my experience, I was chatting to my vet down in Florida about this because we'd kind of tag teamed some of the education that we were doing about this. And for the external abscesses, the advice was to kind of let them mature, then draining them and providing supportive care. Sometimes antibiotics aren't even needed. You're getting rid of the fluid and they can heal internal to external. So it looks ugly, but it's something that can be managed fairly well. For the internal disease or limb involvement, it was a little bit more intensive. Also included long-term antibiotics and monitoring and supportive care. So it was a little bit less of an easy option when you have a horse with that.
And what does the prognosis typically look like for some of these more serious cases?
Yeah, so with the external abscesses, it's actually pretty good. Horses recover pretty quickly in a couple weeks. For internal abscessation, it's a bit more serious. So in prognosis, a little bit more guarded, longer recover time. Sometimes we're looking into the months, and there's a certain number that aren't successful. They don't successfully recover. It depends on the influence of those abscesses and the critical organs that they're near or on. For the limb infections, they kind of fall somewhere in between. So it's a little bit of a slower recovery. Some end up with residual swelling in those limbs. So early recognition is really what makes the difference here, especially for those internal diseases.
How can veterinarians help their clients prevent pigeon fever, especially as we're seeing the epidemiology shift more to different regions where people may be less familiar with it?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of work that vets can do. Obviously, they're trained to handle a lot of these infectious diseases and give supportive care and work with the owner on how to manage whether antibiotics are needed and all of those pieces. So they can give that early detection. They can give examples or plans for biosecurity, when to isolate the animals. But this is where vets and entomologists or folks working in extension really need to work together. Because it's not just about the horse, which is what the vets excel at, but it's also about the environment and the arthropods, which is what the entomologists excel at. So it's important to have really good fly management strategies, and that's going to go beyond sometimes what vets have training for. They only get a couple weeks of parasitology in vet school, so, you know, and I get zero in vet training. So, you know, we work together, we can have a better plan. And so we can give more specific recommendations, not just put on fly spray, but how you manage your manure and what that timing would look like and what fly species are important to control for. So what traps and what baits are going to work for for those flies. So it's really a team effort. And I would encourage anybody, if you have a horse that's diagnosed with pigeon fever, you're concerned about it, or you just want to know more about it, to reach out to your state's extension. You probably have somebody in entomology who either can help you with this or can get you in touch with a veterinary entomologist who aren't vets. We just work with pests of non-human vertebrates and can walk you through some of those specifics.
Yeah, that's great advice. Is there anything else that you would like to add about pigeon fever before we wrap up today?
Yeah, I think I just want to emphasize that I think one of the most common mistakes, I don't want to call it mistake, it's not a mistake, it's a focus area. So the common focus is to think just about the horse. And of course, they're the ones that are sick and you want to keep the other horses from being sick. But this is really an environmental concern. And so you really have to think bigger. So if you have contaminated bedding, manure buildup, abscess drainage, all of that's going into the environment. And so you've got to be thinking about how you're going to manage the facility during these times of outbreak, how you're going to manage the flies broadly, not just on the horses, but broadly in the area. And that consistency and that care of the environment are really going to make the difference.
Yeah. How long do facilities stay contaminated?
Well, so the bacteria can just live in the environment, right? So yeah. If you are talking to somebody at UC Davis, for example, in California, it's in the soil. And in theory, if you have a horse that has a wound, it could get into that wound. So it's a little bit more persistent. There than it is in places in the Northeast. And I just don't think we know enough yet to really say, you know, how well it survives cold weather. If some of these cases are coming from horses moving back home in the summer and they get in the soil and then it dies off in the winter, I don't know if we know enough to really say how long it persists in the Northeast. But I would say if you have a facility and you have an animal that was infected, your environment's going to be infected. So the best thing you can do is try and get as much of that off, as much of the waste, as much of the drainage away from your animals, covered, stored, moved as you can, and keep your fly population down to help reduce risk.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Machtinger, for joining us today to talk about pigeon fever.
Absolutely. I was really glad to do so.
I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Machtinger for joining us. And thank you to Equithera for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please email me at csysin@equinenetwork.com.